I'm Christopher Joyce. Welcome to the Science Podcast.
I'm Joe Palca.
Glad you're here, Joe.
I'm glad you're here, Chris.
So what are we going to hear on our podcast this week?
Well, this week, Chris, we're going to stick with some Darwin stuff because it's been Darwin's 200th birthday for a week or two now.
I can't get enough.
It's going to be Darwin's birthday all year long, I think. But there's some interesting pieces that we have about Darwin and education, which we'll be hearing about. And then we have an interesting bit about some extinct mammals. And then I think you have an interesting story about an extant mammal. So that's the roundup.
Good. Let's get started. What are we going to hear first?
Well, the first is comes from a trip that Leanne Hansen took to Kansas. Actually, I went with her. We chose Kansas because there have been culture wars about Darwin in Kansas, whether or not evolution should be the only scientific theory, or the evolution by natural selection should be the only scientific theory taught in schools. And as John Hamilton says in this story, people who are opposed to evolution explaining everything about how life evolved on Earth have come up with a new idea that may say where evolution doesn't work.
Darwin skeptics have honed in on something called the mind-brain problem. It goes like this. How can the brain, which is just a bunch of cells, produce things like consciousness, subjective experience, and free will? And how can these things be the result of evolution? Most brain scientists say there's plenty of evidence that things like consciousness have evolved along with the brain. Stephen Novella is a neurologist at Yale University. He says our minds depend on our brains.
If you change the brain, you change the mind. If you damage the brain, you damage the mind. If you turn off the brain, you turn off the mind. And now with more sophisticated tools, when we're looking at brain function with functional MRI, for example, we can see that brain activity precedes mental activities. And that makes sense because, you know, causes come before their effects.
But Novella adds that scientists don't know how the brain causes the mind.
We know that it does. The evidence that it does is overwhelming, just like we know that life evolved. But we're not sure exactly how, and there's real debate going on about how science needs to further explore that question.
And here's where the Darwin doubters come in. One of them is Michael Egner from the State University of New York, Stony Brook.
I'm a neurosurgeon. I realize how closely the mind and the brain are related. But the question is there something else in addition to the material properties of the brain that we need to invoke to have an adequate explanation for the mind? And I think there is.
Egner says that something else is an intelligent designer that had a hand in producing not only the brain, but all living things and certain features of the universe. Egner says without this designer, the brain would just be a meat computer made up of brain cells.
There is nothing about neurons that scientifically would lead you to infer consciousness from them. They're masses of gelatinous carbon and hydrogen and nitrogen and oxygen, just like other kinds of flesh. And why would flesh have first-person experience? So even logically, it doesn't hang together.
Egner and Novella have been arguing about the mind-brain problem for months now on dueling blogs. Egner writes for a blog called Evolution News and Views, hosted by the Discovery Institute. It's a think tank that's the hub of the intelligent design movement, which rejects Darwinian evolution. Novella writes for a blog called Neurologica, hosted by the New England Skeptical Society. Neither has much respect for the other's ideas.
It struck me as being absurd.
He has a script that he's following.
And of course, that's nonsense.
Logical fallacies, poor reasoning.
And so on. Novella, the Darwinist, says he's written several responses to Egner's contention that brain cells alone can't cause the mind.
The brain uses energy. It can hold information. It can communicate. It can receive sensory input. It could even activate itself and create a loop of ongoing activity. It could do things that can plausibly cause consciousness and self-awareness. So the argument really just falls on its face.
Novella also says Egner is really a creationist who's recycling the religious arguments once used to attack evolution and the idea that natural selection could have produced our genetic code. Egner agrees that some of the same arguments apply.
Whether it's the DNA code or whether it's the mind that understands the DNA code, both require an explanation that transcends what we know of matter.
But he says he's not a creationist.
My personal view is that we have souls and that they're created by God. But you don't have to hold that view to recognize what I think is the evidence that the mind is not entirely material.
Not surprisingly, Egner and Novella have very different views on the Terri Schiavo case. She's the woman in Florida who had severe brain damage and was taken off life support after a legal battle that lasted 7 years. Novella says the court was right to assume that Shivo's mind was determined by her physical brain.
She had significant enough brain damage that it was incompatible with somebody being conscious in any significant way. And it's reasonable to base medical decisions on that scientific evidence. If you also want to bring moral or ethical things into the picture, that's slightly different. You know, science doesn't make moral decisions for us. It just informs our moral decisions.
Hegner says the court was wrong because there's no scientific test that can detect the presence of a mind. And he says anecdotal evidence suggests that even when the brain stops working, the mind can persist. These anecdotes usually involve a person who has nearly died.
The person was able to have mental processes during a time when they were in cardiac arrest and cardiac standstill, and sometimes even with absent EEG waves. So I think that there is very real scientific evidence that the mind in some circumstances can exist without a functioning brain.
Darwinist brain scientists say that in these cases, the brain is still functioning, even if its electrical signals are hard to detect. For the record, Hegner and Novella do agree about one thing. The outcome of the mind-brain debate will have a profound impact on everything from what students learn in high school to how decisions are made at the end of life. John Hamilton, NPR News.
A great story, but I come out of that feeling like I'm stuck in a tautology, you know, like a tar pit, and I can't get out. Because, I mean, Hegner talks about things that cannot be proven, that there's no way, it seems he's saying, to actually test something. And if you can't test it, it's not science.
Right. And the other thing is that things that once seemed remarkable and it must have been done by God, it must have been done by some creative force, we now understand.
Eventually we
get there. Yeah, so science figures it out. And anyway, it's a tricky problem. And I don't think we're going to solve it by the end of this podcast today. I think
let's move on to Kansas then.
Right, let's move on to Kansas, where, as we said, Leanne Hansen and I went to do some stories about Darwin. And Leanne was looking into the interesting question of how students with faith wrestle with that belief system and still work in a science arena.
This is the campus of the University of Kansas in Lawrence. We are here to find out whether students with strong religious beliefs and backgrounds are able to reconcile their studies of the natural sciences with their faith. The long-standing debate between evolution and creationism makes Kansas a good place to ask our questions. And one of the original copies of On the Origin of Species is housed in the university library. Stephen Case is the Associate Director of the Center for Science Education at the university. Although not a native Kansan, Case has lived and worked here most of his life.
We're clearly intellectually superior here in Kansas. You know, I know the rest of the country laughs at us, and that's why I threw out that smart alecky comment. But, you know, we have small towns. About 80% of Kansas is occupied by small towns. And when you live in a small town, when you live in a small community, you all have to live together, which means we're going to have these rich dialogues and these ongoing conversations.
Stephen Case chaired the Kansas Science Curriculum Standards Committee from 2004 to 2005, when the debate over the teaching of evolution was red hot. Today, he teaches science teachers how to teach science. Years ago, he taught science in a private Catholic school and
was a lay minister and lector in the Catholic Church.
Is there a conflict between that which is referred to as creationism and that which is referred to as evolution?
Yes. Our findings in science about the natural world are very humbling for human beings because all of a sudden we're not the special creation. Just like Copernicus removed the earth from the center, Darwin removed human beings from the point of everything.
Just because it's in nature doesn't mean it's good. Ebola is in nature, right? But raise your hand if you think it's good. Oh, you guys. Go ahead.
Patricia Hawley is a psychology professor at the University of Kansas. She's not from Kansas, but she was intrigued by her adopted state and whether the stereotypes about conservative, ultra-religious, and rigid Kansans had any basis. Hawley wanted to know if strong religious backgrounds were a hindrance to learning about science and evolution. So she's conducting a survey, and students in her evolutionary psychology class are taking part.
Because it's an upper-level course and it has evolution right in the title, I don't tend to get a lot of kids in that class who have trouble reconciling their spirituality with science.
We wanted to talk to some science students who also profess strong religious beliefs, so we arranged a meeting at the library.
My name is Natasha DeVore, and I'm a graduate student in the Molecular Biosciences Department.
Do you find you have to reconcile your scientific work with your religious beliefs? If so, why? If not, why not?
I don't know that I've ever had to really reconcile my faith with my science. My science, I see it as an outlet for understanding God's creation more. And I specifically work on proteins, so when I look at a protein, I see God at work in it.
Where do you see God's work in a protein?
I think I see it in the perfection.
Natasha DeVore belongs to a campus organization called the InterVarsity Graduate Student and Faculty Christian Fellowship. Its members are described as broadly yet firmly evangelical. They meet every week or so for Bible studies, book groups, and fellowship. David McLeod also belongs to the group. He's a graduate student in herpetology, studying reptiles and amphibians. McLeod also works at the Natural History Museum and Biodiversity Research Institute. He was very cautious at the beginning of our interview because he wanted to honor both his God and his school.
I love to investigate, and that comes out of both an understanding of science and an understanding of what Scripture has told me about who God is. If God made everything, then what I'm studying is the stuff that God made. And it doesn't matter if it's a bug or a frog or a snake or a worm or a butterfly. It's fascinating stuff.
I'm David Sloan Wilson. I am an evolutionist. I'm not an evolutionary biologist, because an evolutionist studies all things from an evolutionary perspective.
David Sloan Wilson is a distinguished professor in the departments of biology and anthropology at the State University of New York in Binghamton. He's also the author of Evolution for Everyone: How Darwin's Theory Can Change the Way We Think About Our Lives. This past week, he was in Washington, D.C. to speak at a forum titled Evolution, Transcendence, and the Nature of Faith. Wilson is also the head of a consortium of evolutionary science departments at universities across the country. It's like an evolutionary think tank. The group is not only trying to make the word evolution less scary, but also to find ways for students to learn how evolution exists beyond the biological sciences. The consortium is conducting student surveys inspired by Patricia Hawley's at the University of Kansas.
How do we get people to accept evolution? Make it useful. Make it unthreatening, explanatory, and then anyone would embrace such an idea.
There's a quiz you give in your classes.
I ask the audience to describe the morally perfect individual. I get the list that you would expect, you know, love, honesty, sacrifice. It's always the same. And then I ask, describe the most morally reprehensible individual that you could imagine. So now I have these two extreme descriptions, and I conduct three thought experiments. So first, what would happen if you put a good and evil individual together on a desert island? And my students lose no time in saying that the moral individual will become shark food within days.
Here's Wilson's next question.
What would happen if you put a group of good people on one island and a group of evil people on another island, and we make the islands far apart so that there's no travel between islands? Well, my students lose no time in concluding that the group of good people will build a little paradise or a ship to escape the island, and the group of evil people will self-destruct. And then the third experiment is, what happens when we allow one evil individual to paddle over to Virtue Island? And the answer to that question is not obvious, because it's a messy combination.
When you present this to kids that have very strong religious beliefs, is it threatening?
When I listen to religious folks talking to each other, as I do a lot, 95% of it is about peace on earth, goodwill to men, and in a more local, prosaic sense, a good social environment for raising our children, and above all, for transmitting our best values to our children. I mean, transmitting our best values to our children, would that not be cultural evolution?
Heavy food for thought. But What if altruism, which is at the heart of most religious beliefs, actually serves an evolutionary purpose? What if those values meant that the inhabitants of Virtue Island survived, thrived, and multiplied? David Sloan Wilson says that is an effective way to teach evolution to religiously devout students in a non-threatening, meaningful way. Let's hear what our University of Kansas graduate student David McLeod has to say.
How do you integrate faith into your science is really no different for me than it would be for a baker or a trash collector or an engineer. You know, to be a Christian in any of those fields, I hope would be the hallmark of integrity and honesty. But integrating your faith, man, I hope that people who have faith are in all kinds of fields. And man, we need them in science too.
The way that Patricia Hawley and David Sloan Wilson are integrating the theory of evolution into areas beyond biology seems to be working. Preliminary results show that this approach effectively teaches evolution to religious believers and non-believers alike, but does not erode religious faith.
Yeah, you know, when I hear that, Chris, I was in England for some of the Darwin stories I did, and I talked with the Bishop of Oxford, or the former Bishop of Oxford, and, you know, he keeps saying science and religion are meant to answer different kinds of questions. Mm-hmm. One answers the how of life, and the other answers the why of life. And they don't have to be at odds at all. And he says it's only when you take the literal word of the Bible, where creation was 4,000 years ago, or whatever the exact number is in days of Jephthah.
Like,
but anyway, it's only when you go by that specific set of things that the Bible says, and there are all sorts of internal contradictions, but if you take those words as literally true, then you have a problem, because science keeps finding things that seem to be disagreeing with that.
Well, I was glad that Leanne mentioned this idea of altruism as being the cornerstone of faith, and then linking it to evolution, because it does seem, as evolution evolves, as our understanding of it evolves, these things keep cropping up. Altruism possibly being something that a group, rather than an individual, passes on to its own offspring, thus guaranteeing or possibly guaranteeing a better outcome for them. You know, altruism and a religious faith, or an altruism of scientific fact, they're not that different.
Yeah.
What's
next?
What's next? Next is a trip to a tar pit. Well, someplace close to a tar pit. We had an interview on All Things Considered with Michelle Norris, talking to a woman named Robin Turner, who's president of the Archaeopaleo Resource Management Company, which is an outfit that does sort of contract archaeology. And they've, along Wilshire Boulevard, discovered something rather unexpected in downtown Los Angeles, a huge cache of 10,000, 12,000-year-old fossils, and it's quite an amazing story. We've got a little bit of tape from that interview to play.
This is the most wonderful find I could ever have in my entire life, and I'm pretty sure it's the best find, paleontologic find, that there is in the world. And the reason is, it's the entire environment that was kept intact. We have everything from the mammoth all the way down to trees and little bugs with hair on their backs, or little fur on their backs. We have pond turtles. We have birds. We have everything all the way down to algae. We have a stream that goes through the site, so we have freshwater shells. Most paleontologic finds, we find an animal or a few things, but we don't find the entire environment from 10,000 to 40,000 years ago.
That was Robin Turner from the Archaeopaleo Resource Management Company in Los Angeles. Quite happy about what they've dug up. I think, what was it? They're digging up a parking lot?
Yeah, something like that. But I'm still struck by the notion of a fossilized alga.
Is that
the singular of algae?
I've heard it many ways.
Yeah, I think so. Anyway, that's pretty interesting. Well, let's go now from an extinct set of animals to an extant set animal. I love that.
Well done, Joe.
Thank you. Okay, your turn.
Did you do it again?
Yeah, extinct and extant. I get it.
I have got the lucky job every week or two talking to field biologists about recordings that they've made of animals. And this week I talked to a zoology PhD student, Sarah Benson Amram from Michigan State University, who had the lucky assignment of being sent to Kenya to live in a tent for 2 years to study and record the sounds of spotted hyenas, which are pretty cool.
I had been driving around for a couple hours just looking for different hyenas. And it was near a river. The hyena was actually hidden in a hole in the ground, whooping pretty... It was a pretty distressed-sounding whoop. Her name is Pan, one of the top-ranking hyenas in our study clan. She had on her shoulder a lion paw scratch marks. There was also a carcass around 300 meters from this scene, so my guess is that they had had an interaction with lions earlier that morning that I hadn't seen and that they had gotten pretty beat up. Spotted hyenas are really interesting. They live in social groups called clans of up to 90 individuals, and it's a female-dominated society. Spotted hyenas, in particular, are often called laughing hyenas because of this vocalization, the giggle. And it actually has nothing to do with hyenas having a good time. In fact, they're usually pretty stressed out. Often they giggle when they've been attacked. You'll often have just a whole mess of hyenas trying to get access to a carcass. So you'll have one hyena biting another. And when that happens, the hyena that's been bitten will often giggle. So you hear a lot of giggles at carcasses. I love them. They just have personality. You know, there are some that are just really aggressive. There are some that are more playful. Some that are really curious. It's like a soap opera. You follow their lives and you get really involved.
You know, one thing that she told me was that she did almost all of that recording from inside her car, her Jeep. I don't blame her there. I mean, she also told me that hyenas have one of the strongest sets of jaw muscles of all the animals in the world.
Yeah, I think I'd be cautious with that. Well, anyway, I guess that's about it for this week. What do you got coming up, Chris?
I don't have much of anything coming up.
Well, then we don't have to worry about getting you on the podcast next week. I've got an interesting story. I mean, maybe it's good enough it'll get on the podcast about how you tell when a suspension bridge is about to fall down.
Well, good. I'll find that out. Shall I wait before I cross a bridge until the story?
I think you're safe for the time being. But, you know, you might want to double check.
Well, next week we'll be back also with, well, who knows what. But, science is going to offer us another set of stories next week, and
it's
we hope you tune in and... Well, do you tune in on a podcast?
Tune in, drop down.
Such a 20th century concept.
Tune in.
Come back.
Download, whatever you do, do it.
Come back next week, and we'll have more podcasting for you. And if you've got any ideas about what you'd like to hear or what you like that we're doing or not doing, just drop us a line at nprscience@npr.org. Bye-bye.
Toodles.
Come on, skinny love, just let's see it.